walks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animals, talking animals.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guest today is Michael Weber, the producer-director of the new documentary, The Conservation Game, which focuses on the efforts of Tim Harrison, a retired policeman who has long reflected a passionate interest in the nefarious black market commerce involving big cats and other exotic animals. Indeed, Harrison stood similarly at the center of a previous Weber doc, 2011's The Elephant in the Living Room. Harrison, by the way, was a guest on Talking Animals about that very film 10 years ago, almost to the day. In the new film, while checking out an exotic animal auction, Harrison experiences a jarring epiphany, suggesting that the high-profile folks who bring animals on the late-night talk shows and morning news programs, what the movie calls celebrity conservationists, most famously including Jack Hanna, may be secretly cogs in the wheels of the exotic pet trade. This launches Harrison on an investigative journey that propels the film, along with some parallel narratives like the effort to pass the Big Cat Public Safety Act, featuring Tampa's Howard and Carol Baskin of Big Cat Rescue. The Conservation Game is a top-tier documentary that also brims with the thrilling cinematic elements of a mystery, and by the end, viewers will likely never quite look at Jack Hanna the same way. We'll discuss The Conservation Game with its director, Michael Weber, in just a few moments here on Talking Animals on WMNF. Later in today's program, I'll speak briefly with Maddie Stone, marketing manager at Great Explorations Children's Museum in St. Petersburg, which is holding a pet day with SPCA Tampa Bay this Friday, August 27th. We'll hear what's in store for that event later in today's program. Right now, though, let's discuss celebrity conservationists, furiously making air quotes around that phrase, and the links it may have to the exotic trade and more with Michael Weber. With a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. This is Michael Weber on Talking Animals on WMNF. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning. Great to be with you.
Thank you so much for joining us. First of all, congratulations on the film. Even though I'm steeped in a lot of these issues and have interviewed some of the people, in fact, featured in the film, I still found this documentary eye-opening and downright jarring at times. So we have plenty to talk about. I guess one of the things I'm curious about right off the bat is you've worked on a lot of films and TV shows and other projects over the years. But what stands out to me, at least, is that you've now made two documentaries kind of exploring the black market commerce involving big cats and other exotic animals. Why?
Well, I guess, you know, the first documentary that I did, The Elephant in the Living Room, you know, I embedded myself pretty deep into the exotic pet trade with dealers, with exotic pet owners. I spent a couple years in there, and I think when you do something like that, you'll never be the same again. You know, what you see, what you experience, what you learn, and then, you know, the results that we see in the film, you know, really changed me forever. And so, you know, I really then had a heart for these animals, particularly the big cats. So I spent a lot of time around big cats at that time. And then although I did another documentary after that, I continued to work in the big cat advocacy space, continued to be involved in with people in a lot of rescues, many, many rescues, and always knew that I wanted to probably come back to an issue, you know, that revealed itself to me 10 years ago at that time, which kind of brings us back to the conservation game. So it really is a passion project, and these issues had become very close to my heart.
Yeah, because it's, it truly must be obviously a passion project, and it makes sense that having worked in that first one, you kind of were forever changed and probably couldn't shake off a lot of what you saw and witnessed and thought, well, I'm not done making a film or films about this area. But even those of us with only a remedial knowledge of documentary films understand that the docs typically involve years of work and mountainous challenges and all kinds of other things that come along. And at the same time, they aren't usually considered a get-rich scheme. So So the fact that you've undertaken two documentaries that deal with this whole kind of underworld of buying and selling big cats and other endangered species, I guess it's just at this point, it truly is a passion project. But I guess backing up a little further, even before that point, what drew you first to this area to begin with, before you made The Elephant in the Living Room? Was your background kind of as an animal guy? Were you always sort of intrigued and involved with animals or concerned about them? And that kind of then naturally led you to get on the path to that first film?
I think the answer is yes, but probably no more than anybody else, you know, in the general public. I mean, I was doing producing and co-producing films for 20th Century Fox and for Lionsgate and some independent films. You know, so nothing that really touched on the animal issues. There wasn't a member of the Humane Society or PETA or anything like that. What drew me to it was, as a producer, a lot of times you'll receive material, scripts, books, and you're reviewing a lot of articles and materials to look at what might be our next film. A lot of times books. And so people would bring that material to you, you know, quite often. And actually a friend of mine had given me a book on the subject of this public safety officer in Ohio who, and his exploits, he actually had two books, of having to capture and relocate these exotic animals that people were keeping as pets. And I remember I was in Poland at the time working on a film. And I spent about a couple years there, but in my final, you know, several months there, I had these books with me and I would read them. And I was just, you know, totally enamored by the stories that I was reading from this book, you know, by this public safety officer and what he was, as he was pulling tigers out of people's basements, as his own fellow firefighters were getting killed by their exotic animal pets and so forth. Very difficult to believe. And so, you know, these stories really intrigued me. And so then I met the man his name is Tim Harrison. And actually, I really wanted to pursue this. Naturally, I looked at this as what kind of film would this be? Because that's the way that we think as producers. And obviously, this was not a scripted film. This had to be a documentary. I had never done a documentary. And actually, I wanted to give that a try. In order to, in a way, kind of take a hiatus maybe from the scripted studio films that I was doing. It gave me an opportunity to come back home where I lived, which was Ohio, and spend some time there. So naively, I believed that this would be sort of a three-month hiatus. Well, I might go and kind of do a personal passion project. Once I got into it, that ended up taking me off the radar for about 2.5 years, where I just vanished and threw myself into this work, and that's, you know, the result of that ended up being The Elephant in the Living Room. That became the number one independent film in the country, one of the highest reviewed movies of the year, and you know, 5 best documentary awards and so forth. And obviously, I stayed in that space ever since. Nothing else compared once I started doing Cinema Verite documentaries.
Yeah, once again, isn't it always interesting sometimes how just by accident or just trying something different, and again, at the moment you thought, okay, well, let me get into this. It could be a nice break, 3 months, and I'll be back doing what I normally do. And yeah, the story was quite different, but then actually sounds like it couldn't have been more of a success on a bunch of different levels.
I think it kind of gave me an example too, and even for you and your listeners, where, you know, it's something very different when you do something that you're passionate about and that's from the heart.
Yeah.
Honestly, the it's really interesting. The film that I had just finished at that time ended up, I believe, being one of the worst films of the year.
Oh, really? Do you want to say what that was, or rather not?
No, but, you know,
yeah.
One of the reasons is you kind of get into this funk where you feel like the studios and producers were sort of engineering films, in a sense.
Yeah.
And so it was really revealing to me to go from doing that to something that we're not engineering, something that you're doing purely out of passion. You have no budget. You also have no timeline. You don't know where this is going to end and where it will take you. And so you just put your head down, use the competency that you have and all your various skills and say, I'm going to see this through to the end no matter what. That's very, very different than what you do with scripted, budgeted, you know, studio type films.
Yeah.
And what was interesting for me is we see two very different results from those two different processes. And it's very difficult really to go back.
Oh, I would think, yeah. And especially too, that you've got the combination in this case, or at least two films cases, of your own growing passion initially and then sustaining passion. But Tim Harrison, who again is kind of pivotal to both films, obviously, he's got considerable passion. So I think when you get at least two major parts of that puzzle that are really, really passionate and driven by that, and the opposite of, like you say, of just kind of like trying to assemble a film and let's get this and let's get this person and let's shoot it here and let's hope for the best. And as you say, sometimes that works okay. Sometimes you end up with a film that's, I guess, one of the worst films of the year, which sounds funny in a way. But so for people who haven't seen thus far, at least maybe either film, certainly probably few have seen The Conservation Game. Talk a little bit more about Tim Harrison. Obviously, his books are what pulled you in and launched you both on this path. But tell us about him and sort of what you learned after you read the books and met, got together with him, and then subsequently what you've further come to know about him in the wake of doing not one but two films about him.
Yeah, I mean, the simple way of describing it is I've never met anybody like him ever. He's a police officer, firefighter, paramedic, so he's all three. He also happens to have a heart for these animals. He's in the Martial Arts Hall of Fame. You know, his credentials and his experiences are just tremendous. And
yeah.
One curious thing about him that I thought was interesting when I met him is he's had so much experience having to capture and relocate these apex predators, these very dangerous animals. And I'm talking dozens and dozens, maybe hundreds. And so we're talking about crocodiles, alligators, some of the most venomous snakes in the world, cougars, tigers that he's walking out of peaceful basements and so forth. I mean, he caught a mountain lion that was being kept as a pet with his bare hands and a dog snare, and he doesn't have a scratch on him. Nothing like that has ever been done in the world. Usually you have to shoot and destroy the animal, or you'll have to dart it if you're lucky enough to be able to do that. And, you know, there was an incident that happened in Dayton, Ohio that he ran into where a mountain lion was chasing his fellow police officers, and there was no time to deal with it. And this happened to have been a pet that someone was keeping. And he caught that animal with his bare hands and a dog snare. And so what you see is, like, if you look at, Crocodile Hunter and Dave Salmoni, a lot of the animal guys who are on TV and on the cable shows, they love to brag and show off all the different ways that they've been attacked, all of their different scars, all of their scratches. And they love to talk about that. When you look at Tim Harrison, he's the real deal. He's dealt with that many, many more times than they have. And he doesn't have a scratch on him. That's what's so interesting. He doesn't have a single scratch on him. And that just shows the competency that he has and how different he is with and around these animals. He's a pretty remarkable guy.
Yeah. Well, just to sort of add to that story, perhaps, Michael, is that the story about them capturing the mountain lion with his bare hands, I mean, partly because his colleagues were being chased. I mean, I'm going to guess without knowing that at least one or more of the people in that story probably had some kind of weapon near them or on them. And the fact that that was never brought out, never discharged, and he just subdued the mountain lion without just saying, well, we've got a mountain lion charging us. I guess that's as good an excuse as any to pull out a weapon. Apparently that just never even entered the picture.
Exactly. And he credits his martial arts training and all of his training from his fighting days to allow him to be able to, you know, physically do a lot of the things that he has done, aside from all this background and experience with animals too. So I don't think we'll ever see anyone like Tim in the world ever again. He's pretty special. And so we had become very, very dear friends, and one of the reasons why we've had so much success with The Elephant in the Living Room, and I think now with The Conservation Game, in terms of being able to reveal to the public what's going on, and this kind of backs up to what we were talking about, the sacrifices that it takes to make contemporaneous cinema verite-type documentaries like I do, is it requires someone like Tim to partner with, in a sense, who will never give up, who will keep on going, who's willing to go into that dark room and feel your way around and not knowing where the exit is, no matter how long it takes, no matter where the story takes us, to keep on going and pushing and persevering into the unknown. And he and I are like-minded that way. And it's really that combination that has allowed me to do what I've wanted to do with documentary film and storytelling, and has allowed us to, you know, bring these stories and these issues to the public.
Yeah. Well, that brings me, I think, to a specific question that I want to ask about Tim relative to the conservation game. But in case folks might have just tuned in the last few minutes, I want to let them know this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you did just tune in, my guest is Michael Weber, director of the new documentary, The Conservation Game, which explores the realm of people who bring animals on late-night talk shows and morning programs and elsewhere, but also maybe secretly participating in the exotic pet trade. And I think it may be safe, as we'll get into a bit later, to say viewers of this film might never look at Jack Hanna quite the same way. If you'd like to ask Michael a question about his film or the exotic pet trade or a related issue, or if you'd just like to offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663. Email dj@wmnf.org or text 813-433-0885. So to follow up what you're saying about this release, probably never going to be again someone quite like Tim Harrison. I don't think it's a spoiler to mention that the central story here was something, at least appeared, that Tim kind of stumbled into while checking out an exotic animal auction. Do you want to touch on, to whatever degree you'd like, the sort of epiphany that Tim had at that auction and to what extent, I guess, that sort of launched the conservation game?
Yeah, absolutely. Tim and I went to an exotic animal auction. I went undercover. One challenge with Tim is that when he shows up at places like that, he's very recognizable. All of the dealers, they all know who he is. They all know that he seeks to uncover what it is that they're doing and to sort of make things right by passing laws and regulations and to make things better for the animals and safer for people. You know, so he kind of has to stay in the background a little bit, too, when we go to these places. In that case, it was about 10 years ago. And in the case that we're talking about, and it was while I was filming The Elephant in the Living Room. And so what we did anticipate, and what I anticipated, is we would see all of these outrageous activities that are revealed in the film, which is the general public coming in, purchasing cougars, tigers, primates, you know, baboons, monkeys, anything you can imagine. No licenses required, a lot of cash changing hands. And they basically take them home and put them in their car and take them home and do who knows what with them, you know, after that. No regulations, no license required. But what I didn't anticipate is something that happened there that I wouldn't have imagined in a million years. And that is, while Tim and I were there, I look over to my side, and what I saw was a celebrity conservationist, for lack of a better term, someone who was on the late night shows, morning shows, who my kids grew up watching. Ironically, they were probably watching on that Saturday while I was there at the auction. That person was there at the auction in person. Now, remember, there's no cameras allowed at these auctions, and I was there with hidden camera. They were participating in that auction, buying and selling animals, essentially feeding into the exotic pet trade. And so that raised a whole lot of questions. What is this person doing there? Are these the animals that we are seeing on TV? Are the animals that we see on TV on these shows, these ambassador animals, as they're frequently called, are these the ones that are ending up in people's backyards? Are these the ones that Tim is actually later having to rescue people from and have to take to sanctuaries and rescues when they get too big for the owners? So that was the most shocking thing that I saw. And then Tim and the other public safety officer had also experienced running into one of the providers, and we'll just tell your audience, for Jack Hanna, that provides animals for him to go on morning shows and late shows, was also there participating at the auctions and actually told them specifically that she was unloading animals that Jack had used on TV and getting some more for his next appearance. Now, that was so controversial and so difficult to process and to understand what was going on. I actually took that footage and shelved it. You don't see that in The Elephant in the Living Room, because I knew that this was so big and I knew that it warranted its own investigation, potentially its own film, that I'd have to kind of come back to this later. And I did several years later. And that's really the flashpoint and the genesis eventually of the investigation that leads to the, or I'm sorry, the conservation game.
Okay, that's interesting, because I wasn't quite sure till you just explained this right now, like what the chronology was. Like, I wondered if you guys were sort of planning to make a film broadly aimed at this topic, and then the experience at the auction kind of simply helped focus the story being told. But it sounds like really, like that, the experience was the pivotal thing to build the film around. It's just that you were busy with the other film then and had other things going, so you came back to it and then explored what we do see in the remaining part of the conservation game. Do I have that right?
Yeah, and we knew too that one of the reasons why it was shelved is that we knew it was going to be impossible. We were told, you know, what we see in the conservation game and what eventually becomes revealed from that auction and then continues for years after and then continues to, you know, modern times that you see when we filmed the conservation game, is that kind of everyone in the industry knew what was going on. You know, so the dealers, people at the zoos, the celebrity conservationists themselves, like this is sort of an open secret. Among the industry. The problem was the conspiracy, if you want to call it that, the cover-up, the ruse that was being performed on the public was so good, in a sense, that you could never really prove it. You know, so you have these various things that you see and experience and suspect that really need an explanation, and there seems to be only one explanation for it, and that is these individuals that we see on TV posing as conservationists that we've watched for years and years and years are actually involved with the backyard breeders, the roadside zoos. You know, they're tangentially connected with the exotic pet trade. Well, how could you ever prove that? How could you say that that tiger cub that you see on one of the morning shows is one that ends up in somebody's backyard at a birthday party? Or how could you even figure out where it went whatsoever? Our laws are so loose. You can't track them. They're not named. They're not microchipped. And so how could you do that? So everybody in the industry, you know, it's almost like we all know what's going on, but you could never prove it. And so that was the challenging undertaking from the beginning, where I had a team that said, oh, we're going to do this no matter what it takes, no matter how long it takes. And we're going to solve sort of the unsolvable mystery in the industry. And had a very competent group of people who are tenacious, and even with us, it took us 3.5 years to do it.
Wow. Yeah, well, we really see this huge, sprawling kind of investigation and how it's attempted to be thwarted at every turn, really, by those very conservationist people we see on all those late-night shows and morning shows and stuff. That brings me to a more specific question, but let's get a caller involved in the meantime. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Michael Weber.
Hi, Duncan.
Hi.
Hey, I have when I was in my 20s, a friend of mine had a neighbor across the street, and it turned out he had two, I guess, Florida panthers, full grown, one of which was mostly in a cage, and the other he kept on a tether, in his, like you said, in his backyard. I think what he said was he was somehow rehabilitating them. But this guy was very, I remember once I went into the backyard, and he let me go back there maybe 2 feet inside the fence, and the cat made a move to me, and the tether barely pulled it back. I had to press myself up against the fence. Another time, he actually brought one of them across the street into my friend's house on a leash, like it was a dog. Mm. And the poor guy, he had a house cat, and the cat, I mean, all the hair started going up, and he started drooling. The poor thing was, like, traumatized.
Yeah.
Now, is it possible that people can have a cat at home that to rehabilitate, or is that just not true? You know what I mean? That was really irresponsible, you know, to be leading this thing was full grown. It was like four feet. It was huge, you know?
Yeah. Go ahead, Michael.
I think it's a great question, and what's interesting is while that experience that you had is incredibly unique to you and memorable, what's interesting when I hear this is I've heard and seen that so many times. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't know about that case specifically, but what I have seen over and over again, it's almost this sort of ubiquitous among these exotic animal owners, is they say the exact same thing. And in fact, we see that even within the celebrity conservationists themselves. What they will say is, this is a, quote, rescued animal. This one, we had to pull it from its mother because she wouldn't nurse it correctly, or I'm rehabilitating this, or we rescued it. And so that, and it turns out many times when they say that, I actually suspect that it's not true because I've actually found out where those animals actually came from. But you see that messaging trickle down to the exotic animal owners themselves, you know, so they will say that as well. And the question is, rescued it from what? The exotic, you know, animal auction that you purchased it from, or rehabilitating it from what? That cougar didn't come from the wild. I can guarantee you that. So
yeah, this was in a suburb, so it's not like they came across it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Exactly. And so you just hear that same message all the time from exotic animal owners. And I've never seen a case when it's ever been true. But the reason they do that is it makes the people around them, and maybe them too, feel better about what it is that they're doing. Because if they told you the truth, which is, I actually purchased this for $1,000 at an auction, or I got this from some other dealer when it got too big for him, you know, they'll come up with that different type of messaging to make you or them feel better about the fact that they have a predator on a leash that they keep in their yard, that they walk around the neighborhood. Right. And the leash sort of thing is something too, when we see this on TV, you know, people like this person that you ran into, they learn this from our celebrity conservationists. Why? Because they will bring these animals on a leash too. So while they tell us they're not pets, they're literally treating them like a pet. They'll bring the cubs on TV and play with them just like it's a dog or a house cat. And then they will even take full-grown ones on a leash and walk them around too and tell you it's not a pet. I mean, right there in Florida, that also happened with an owner. I wonder if this is the same one who had a cougar or a mountain lion. And then one of the neighbors was watching it, and then while they were out of town, this happened a few years ago, and then that neighbor who was watching it brought a girlfriend over, and it got a hold of her, and it ripped the back of her head off.
Oh my God.
So, no,
yeah, I mean, the paws of that cat were maybe 6 inches from my back. I mean, I was that close to getting, I think, mauled, you know?
Yeah. So, well, I think that may further answer your question, just because...
Thank you.
If there's any rehabilitating or anything going on, I think people have, first of all, probably not just a house in a suburb. Secondly, probably much better caging and safer setup. And just everything about that just sounds like a bunch of red flags waving furiously.
It's very sketchy. What about, I'll let you go, just what about shows like I grew up with Mutual of Omaha, Wild Kingdom, you know, with Marlon Perkins. Do you know anything about that show? And I'll listen to you on the air. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for your call.